Hello, everybody. This is your host, Bob Wintermute, welcoming you back to New Books in Military History. Each month, we pick a new book related to topics in military history and interview the author to learn new insights about their work and the historical process. This time, we're interviewing two authors of essays in an edited collection, Scraping the Barrel, The Military Use of Substandard Manpower, 1860 to 1960. With 11 different essays covering a range of national case studies over the modern era, Scraping the Barrel offers numerous points of view on the issue of substandard manpower, what it is, and how military institutions revise their perspectives of it in times of great need. First, we speak with the book's editor, Sanders Marble, about the challenges of creating an edited collection, as well as about his own essay, Below the Bar, The U.S. Army and Limited Service Manpower. Then we will take some time to speak with another essay contributor, Thomas Sticht, about his essay, Project 100,000 in the Vietnam War and Afterward, after which we'll return to Sanders Marble for a few closing comments. Welcome back to New Books in Military History. This is your host, Bob Wintermute. Today we're going to be departing a bit from our normal format as we're interviewing several authors related to their contributions to Sanders Marble's edited collection on manpower readiness. The book is entitled Scraping the Barrel, The Military Use of Substandard Manpower, 1860 to 1960. How are you doing today, Sanders?
Fine, Bob. Thanks for having me.
Well, good to have you. For our readers, in essence, this book is a collection of case studies which examine how military institutions have defined readiness and eligibility for military service. Also, how wartime necessity and contingency alters peacetime notions of service eligibility. As the editor of the book, Sanders is going to be our first guest, and he's going to place the project into the proper context and speak briefly about his own contribution to the volume. Following Sanders' interview, I'll introduce a second contributor, giving him a chance to speak about his own piece. And then at the end, we're going to return to Sanders Marble for a summary of the work at large. That said, Sanders, why don't you introduce yourself?
Okay. I went undergraduate to William & Mary and then did graduate work at King's College, University of London, where I didn't really pay attention to manpower. I was looking at artillery in World War I, but as I perhaps matured or certainly aged as a scholar, I got interested in other facets. And somebody talked to me about actually how the Germans used, reached deeper and deeper into their manpower pool in World War II, and when I was introduced to that idea, I started looking around for other examples. And when you look for something, you often find things. They may not be the best examples because sometimes you look too hard, but you find them. And then I got lucky. I got the idea for a book on this because I didn't see anything like it.
Mm-hmm.
There's all kinds of work about elites. Elite units, very common. And look at military elites, often the sort of sociological perspective of officers and military coups and who takes, who runs the military and their interaction with political elites.
Right.
But not so much with the guys on the substandard guys with packs on their backs and shovels or rifles in their hands.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked around and, I had these case studies in mind, looked around to find people to write about them, and was very lucky to find people that were not only interested in writing about it, but knew about it. These people know way more about their subject than I do, which is I try and lure you into a digression here. I think one of the strengths of an edited collection is that you get people, you can get the subject matter experts in where there's not a full book to be written on any one of these topics.
Right.
And certainly another strength is I could never write about most or even probably any of these topics as well as somebody who knows it well. And certainly I couldn't do most of the foreign case studies because I don't have the languages. So that, I think that's a strength of an edited collection. And for the people that like this or are interested in the peeling the sausage open, the drawback was in some ways the length that it took this project to get done.
Right. Well, I'm sure when you're working with so many disparate voices who are all experts in their field, you know, it's very hard for you as the editor to bring them to heel, to say, you know, we only have a certain amount of space limitations or a certain amount of word count that we're permitted. And, you know, as much as you would like to let them have free rein, you really can't.
Most of them were very good. It was my first editing experience, and I am lucky. I also learned as I went. There was indeed, I'll put it no more firmly than negotiation about word length with some of the authors.
Sure.
And what was fair to, you know, to not just get into the nuances and complexities of their case study, but not swamp the book with, you know, a dissertation on one topic and then,
sure,
a short overview of something else.
Well, I mean, you certainly have some pretty significant names at work as well, too, who are making contributions to the work. Dennis Showalter, Val Lumens, Tom Stitch, who we'll be talking to later in his role with Project 100,000. Those are just a few of the names of the people who are involved. And, you know, I can see very much where that would be an issue about trying to balance these different voices and make sure that no one receives top billing or over any other.
Yeah, it was especially the first time out of the box on it. It was a little more daunting, and I think everybody came away content. I think somewhere between content and pleased.
Well, as a reader, I was quite content with the book. I mean, it's a fascinating series of questions and topics that just go, I feel, far deeper than superficial issues about physical physical competency or physical strength when you're defining what substandard is. You know, in fact, you yourself know in the introduction that the term substandard is extremely subjective. You know, it's open to redefinition across not only across the scope of different conflicts, but across the duration of a single conflict. Does this shifting definition of normalcy, is it something that occurs regularly, you think?
Yeah. I think pretty much every long war, or sometimes even a short war, thinking, you know, short war, the War of 18, the Spanish-American War, from April to officially December, the peace treaty in December, but, you know, the fighting's over in June, July, 1898, you know, a few months of actual conflict. And as soon as the U.S. tries to expand its army, manpower standards, peacetime manpower standards went out the window. But it's certainly noticeable in the big mobilizations, the industrial wars of the 20th century.
Right.
Where you have sustained combat, large forces needed, lots of casualties, men who are, and mostly this focuses on men, because I felt that women in the military was a subject that was already well explored.
Sure.
And it is different from saying a woman is a substandard man. But, you know,
I'm not going to touch that one.
I mean, yeah, it's different. But you have men who have been wounded or injured or sick and can return to some duty, but not full duty. And then the military is left with the question, I can't find a man from the civilian world who is any better than this guy. What's the right answer? Has he served his... Has this injured or wounded man served his duty to his country? Should he be discharged? And I get somebody who is less experienced, but no physically better or mentally better, or you know, by whatever manpower standards we are judging, because many of these case studies, some of these, well, race is a factor.
Sure.
Ethnicity can be a factor in what is substandard. And I didn't get also didn't get into use of colonial troops,
right.
Troops from an empire. Again, there is more work on imperial levies, raising colonial or imperial troops.
Mm-hmm.
And I also, there's a limit on how long a book can be. This
right.
book, I hope, opens the topic to other people to revisit these in more depth or look at other time periods.
Mm-hmm.
You could go back to the early modern period. You could look at some of the Asian countries, which I didn't get into.
Mm-hmm.
Or look at navies and air forces.
True. You know, as I think about it and reflecting upon reading the book too, I mean, it's what we're talking about in terms of eligibility and substandard qualifications and what makes one fit. It is so transcendent. I mean, we're talking about issues related to gender and masculinity. We're talking about issues of citizenship and representation in the civic model or the larger consensus. And, you know, you're right. There's so many different ways that those themes can also be interwoven into future study, which I think is part of what makes this a landmark work for people in the field.
Again, I hope so. Partly because I hope it does start discussion and debate.
Mm-hmm.
And also reaches beyond the military history community, and most of the people I got to write this would call themselves a military historian. Tom Stick is a sociologist,
mm-hmm.
Unabashedly, and I don't think less of him for it. and I think for looking at Project 100,000, that's the right mindset and skill set.
Well, particularly since apparently he was present at the creation as well, which gives him a whole another kind of voice, I think, to
right.
his piece.
But I think it would be good for some of the disability historians, for the people who thinking of themselves in other specialties in history, as you identify, citizenship, social history, to look at the military and look at this topic.
Right. Well, let's turn to your own essay, which was titled "Below the Bar: The U.S. Army and Limited Service Manpower." And, of course, this is related to the interwar years. Well, the First World War and the interwar years between 1919 and 1941. I think there's a little surprise for experts on American mobilization of the concept of the limited service or the C classification in the Selective Service Act. But can you briefly summarize what this classification meant, what defined being in this classification for our listeners?
Sure. World War I, the draft was written very broadly, but when the U.S. And the first million men were drafted and had they were 21 to 30 and had generally good health, and because the army was not expecting to expand too large. The second draft comes along when Pershing says, I don't need just 1 million men, I need several million men. The draft ages get extended down to 18 and up to, 40. The manpower standards have to be lowered to meet the numerical targets. And the Army also finds that it has a need for people with certain skills.
Mm-hmm.
Needed carpenters to build building barracks and mess halls in the U.S. It needed electricians. It needed painters. It needed drivers. It needed pharmacists. It needed all kinds of people with specialty skills. But those specialty skills are not typically carrying a rifle with a bayonet. And, in fact, nobody in civilian life does that.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty much against the law to have a private army. So the Army said was convinced by, interestingly, some psychologists who were pretty much working in human resources that you don't need. If you need a carpenter, you need a carpenter. You don't need a man who is in his physical prime, but needs to be taught which end of a hammer is which. Mm-hmm. It makes more sense for you to take a trained carpenter who is of lower physical skill or physical ability, and use him as a carpenter. And this fit, I think, the progressive ideal of the time.
Mm-hmm.
It looked very practical. It looked very businesslike. And this is, of course, the era of Taylorism in the U.S.
and
spreading abroad. Although I'm sure that I would get slapped upside the head and told much better dates for Taylorism and stuff.
Not by me, I assure you.
Okay. But it looks sensible. And on paper, it is sensible. If you can stabilize, you know, if you find the right man for the right job, and then no other circumstance changes, you know,
right.
the army's needs change or the man's abilities change, they don't even need him in a different place, the construction project never finishes, you know, if things don't change, then all is well.
Mm-hmm.
But the army embraces it. They draft in tens of thousands of men who are deliberately called up because of their skills, with the expectation that they will be below physical standards.
Mm-hmm.
And there is also a lowering of physical standards in the second draft. But that's those men, even with the lower standard, those men are considered A-class manpower, top-notch manpower.
Right.
And the substandard men are largely used in administrative jobs. A lot of them go to administering the draft, which was run out of the Provost Marshal General's office.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them go to paper pushing jobs, some into warehouses.
Mm-hmm.
Where they need smart is not necessary, because substandard was below standard in anything.
Right.
So it was very broad brush. If you were, you know, missing half your left foot, or you were missing a few gray cells, you were substandard. And, mm-hmm. and that leads to problems in World War II of it's too broad a brush.
Right. Well, so much what you're describing seems to be tied as well, like you said, the progressive notions of whiteness and identity, not just, you know, scientific classification. What I'm getting to is that it seems like many of the men that we categorized as limited service were recent immigrants to the United States. You know, that was their sole limitation. How was this policy received throughout the country?
There was a small clamor in the chattering classes, the middle class that would be decide in of course these progressive days were. The working class was meant to progress, but not so much that they really challenged the ruling class, mm-hmm. perhaps. But when the results of the first draft are in, and people are shocked at how many men are not meeting manpower or physical standards to get into the army.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there is a hope for uplift. That the draftees who were illiterate in English, they might well be literate in their native tongue, you know, they're immigrants, would be taught enough English. They would be Americanized.
That right.
Men who had not had the opportunity to finish even grade school would be drafted into the army. They would be taught enough to be useful to the army and thus be more useful to the country. Again, some uplift there. Also, there was a hope for physical remediation, some hernias, for instance, or flat feet,
mm-hmm.
where there were simple operations that could be performed on a man. Interesting questions then about consent, which don't really get raised because informed consent isn't really a concept.
Right.
Time.
I'm thinking in terms of dental care, too, I would imagine, you know, for the first time, some people having their teeth actually cared for properly.
Yes. Dental insurance did not really exist at the time. And most of the work of the Army Dental Corps was yanking and drilling and filling, mm-hmm. not much creating false teeth, but fixing, at least at the macro level, what was already there.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was a certain selfish element for the chattering classes, because if you could Americanize if you could physically improve or educationally improve somebody from a tenement or a sharecropper, black or white, doesn't matter,
mm-hmm.
Then you don't have to draft my son.
Right. Right. That's something in my own work I've come across with reference to letters from Pennsylvania farmers to the Secretary of War, Newton Baker, complaining about that very issue, that in their communities they see their own sons being taken in larger numbers. And these are all WASP families. Mm. WASP, what they describe as the local hunkies or the local Poles and such, people who work in steel mills and doing other industrial labor, were being left behind. And, of course, all of these letters have connotations of a declining level of whiteness and the effect on the nation's regenerative powers in peacetime. It's quite fascinating reading, and I can imagine then that that plays out as well in this debate.
I think so. I didn't get into too much the internal politic or either the external politics in the country.
Mm-hmm.
This idea seems to have slipped down the Army's throat with virtually no opposition.
Mm.
Inside the Army. I think it did impress the Army with the efficiency. When they're building camp, whatever it is, say Camp Travis in North Texas, they have to, they need carpenters, they need electricians, they need plumbers. And this way, they can find them easily. And they fall in love with it. In fact, they start saying, well, any job that's not right up in the front lines can be coded for the man with the skills instead of being a perfect physique.
Hmm.
I think there's some the failings in here are that things change over time.
Right.
And perhaps in World War I, the war was over too soon for the U.S. to find the shortcomings.
Well, what happened to the limited service category after 1919? It didn't just disappear, did it?
The men pretty much did, but the category gets written into not war plans, but mobilization plans. And they say, we will do this again after the war, and some of the very fat the Committee for the Classification of Personnel, which was the psychologists who had pitched this idea to the Army,
mm-hmm.
They write up, volume one is what they did, in finest back padding historical term. And volume two is, here's the forms that you will need for next time, and here's the improvements over the flaws that we had this time, because we didn't know what we were getting into. They left that on the shelf. There was discussion of it at places like the Army War College and what was then the Army Industrial College, where they're not just thinking about efficient use of manpower in the Army, but also saying, if we the Army efficiently use men, then we will disrupt the labor force less. We won't call up 1,000 guys, disrupt their work for their companies and mm-hmm. the war industry, and only take 200. We will get a higher percentage of people that when we call them up will be usable for us, and therefore less disruption, which is again, it's Taylorism at work, but outside just the military. The military saw itself as part of a system for the war effort, but it stays on the shelf. There's plans on how to use it, when general mobilization is called,
mm-hmm.
And then Franklin Roosevelt never calls for general mobilization there's never a mobilization happens differently in World War II.
Right. Well, how well does the system work in the Second World War? You insinuate or you imply that it doesn't quite work the way they had hoped.
I explained that, in fact, it really doesn't work out the way they expected. First, the draft is limited and only top quality men are called up because they don't need to go. There's no pressing demand for numbers before an actual declaration of war.
Mm-hmm.
And then they do bring call men up. A lot of the problem in World War II is comes by crossing the concepts of limited service quality and psychological value.
Mm-hmm.
The psychiatrists and psychologists both start saying that there are a lot of men who are of questionable stability. And the Army is panicked because the theory of the time is that these men are much more likely to break down in combat,
right,
or break down in service, even if they don't see combat. Therefore, it is much better to screen them out. So there's also with genuine support for the war, there's really no question that, and the Army believes that it will have pretty much unfettered access to the nation's manpower pool.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people say, commanding officers say, why would I take a limited service man, even if he's got skills, when I can send him back and
mm-hmm.
he'll get discharged and I'll get a general service man, a fully fit man, probably with usable skills.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an optimism. There's no, the senior officers that have been trained between the wars on seeing the Army and the economy as both necessary for the war effort, there's not enough of those. And certainly at the small unit level, battalion commanders were discharging men left and right. And so in World War II, you find that hundreds of thousands of men are called up, they are drafted, they receive some training, they are sent to a unit, and then their commander says, I don't want you. And then they get tossed out of the Army.
Mm-hmm.
They're not complaining, most of them, but they are now exempt from the draft. They can never, they would have to volunteer to serve, which I don't think very many of them do. And all this, I have to say, I'm largely looking at policy. It's very hard to find anything at the individual level.
Right.
Expect if somebody that had a great deal of time could look through the surviving information at the National Personnel Records Center in St. Louis.
Well, that's the biggest question, is what's surviving information there is, obviously.
And I don't know. There is material about policy. I found one memoir from a guy who had high blood pressure, was classified as limited service, and said, no, I don't want to be called limited service. And he went off to war.
Mm. The individual role in accepting this status, too.
Yeah. And I think that's one reason in the broader picture why substandard manpower isn't a topic is that the example I had was a man who had high blood pressure.
Mm-hmm.
He would have been in the same category, administrative category, as somebody who had half a left foot, from somebody who was stupid,
mm-hmm.
from somebody who was partly deaf, somebody who had not all their teeth, as you mentioned.
Somebody had stomach ulcers, venereal disease,
Yeah. And in civilian life, they have no similar identity. There's no shared identity among these groups. So the Army class categorizes them one way, but a lot of disability history is looking at identifiable groups,
mm-hmm.
and sometimes self-identifying groups. And these people aren't self-identifying as limited service. because it's a label that somebody else gave them.
Right.
For a short period of their life.
Right. And a very imprecise label at that.
Yeah. But basically the Army, to sort of wrap that up, the Army goes into the war with limited service, doesn't try and I don't think there's good faith in trying to implement it.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of people say, well, why should we do this? And it finds the long-term problems in managing it. And by late 43, they are looking for a new system. And in early 44, they bring in a system that says that you're more precisely identifies your physical abilities.
Mm-hmm.
Looks at your endurance. Your upper and lower, are arms and shoulders sound? Are your legs and feet sound? Is your hearing okay? Is your sight okay? There are six categories, each of which is rated 1 through 4,
mm-hmm.
Which is 24 times more detailed than saying yes or no, limited service or general service. The system is much better at identifying the physical requirements for a particular position, whether it's plumber or truck driver or infantryman, than the previous system.
Mm-hmm.
But trying to implement it during wartime is too much. It's doing a new physical examination on every man in the Army when you have 8 million and then resorting them.
Right.
It was just too much. So it's not until after the war that the physical profile system really takes effect.
Great. Well, we're going to come back to Sanders in a few moments, but first we're going to turn to another of the authors in the collection, Thomas Sticht. Now, as I described earlier, Scraping the Barrel is an edited collection of essays. Each of them deal with a different aspect of the military use of substandard manpower in modern times. We're going to turn our attention now briefly to one of the other contributors to the work, Thomas Sticht, author of the essay Project 100,000 in the Vietnam War and Afterward. Tom, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Before we discuss the essay itself, can you take a few moments to tell us about yourself and how you became interested in this subject?
Oh, sure. Yeah, in 1965, I got a brand new PhD from the University of Arizona, and my first job was at the University of Louisville working with learning problems for blind students, and then I went from there to University of Pittsburgh to work with astronauts on communication skills. And while I was working at Pittsburgh, I got a phone call from people in Monterey, California, asking me if I would be interested in coming out and doing research on listening skills and literacy skills of people who were going to be coming into the military with aptitude scores well below what they ordinarily would accept.
So in a very real way, this isn't just a purely academic research interest. You were actually a participant.
Oh, that's right. No, I was there, and I went to then Monterey, California, and began work. And I was in the background to the work. Then I learned that in 1966, about August 1966, Secretary of Defense Robert Strange McNamara, that was his name, Robert McNamara had started a project where they were going to bring in 100,000 people with aptitude scores below the ordinarily accepted level, and they were interested in how to go about training these people better, and they had brought me in because they thought the military might use listening skills more than literacy skills in some of their training, and that would help overcome some of the learning problems.
Oh, okay.
Out of these new Project 100,000 people, and so I did that. I went to Monterey and began working on the Project 100,000, eventually moving into the design of the new literacy program for the Army called the Functional Literacy Program that subsequently was implemented in all Army training stations around the country.
Okay.
And that's how I got into Project 100,000 and mostly in terms of doing research and training development rather than policy analysis. That came along later.
Okay. Well, for our listeners who aren't, may not be familiar with Project 100,000, who haven't read the book yet, can we review what it was? I mean, as I understand it, it was a program that was intended to not only produce extra manpower for the military, but also was part of President Johnson's own war on poverty.
That's correct. When the war, well, in 1966, probably 1964, President Johnson announced the war on poverty, and he also began conversations with his Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara, on how the military might get involved in this war on poverty. And at that time, in the 1960s, early 60s, there was just a huge amount of inner-city rioting, high unemployment rates for both African-American and white youth. I'm talking unemployment 30 to 40%. And so there was a lot of problem going on in the cities, and Johnson wanted to bring some of the people out of those cities, make them a part then of his war in Vietnam.
Now, just to interrupt you just for a second, though, he wasn't purely targeting urban youth, though, was he? Wasn't he also targeting rural poor as the rural poor
yes.
as well?
Oh, sure. It wasn't strictly that. No, no. It was whoever. People came in from both the rural and the inner cities. But I'm saying a lot of the urgency came out of the rioting
right.
and stuff that was taking place.
Right.
And so in 1966, then McNamara announced the Project 100,000. And the goal was to bring people in who were being excluded more or less from society, bring them in, give them training, give them some good medical care, and give them opportunity for education due to, you know, with the military paying for it, and then to discharge them later on with a leg up in being more successful in society and escaping the cycles of poverty that were talked about at the time. That was
okay.
the overall policy thrust of that.
Right. Now, strictly speaking, what was it that rendered these individuals, you know, to use the language of our book, substandard manpower?
Uh-huh.
What exactly qualified them to be described as such?
Oh, well, they were within the Armed Forces qualification test standards of between the 10th and the 30th percentile. And that was considered by the military policymakers as undesirable, as being slow to train, unusable in many cases. That's how they were described. They were low mental aptitude, and that was not a welcome kind of terminology for people who run the military. So they came into the military then from that kind of a background of having been excluded. And at the time when the Project 100,000 was started, the Army Times raised the issue and said, are we likely to get any use from these people? And the answer is no, as if past performance is any indication. And so these Project 100,000 people came into the military under serious constraints. For one thing, the Army Times didn't think we should be fighting two wars, the war on poverty and the war in Vietnam, at the same time. The Army shouldn't be doing that, they thought. And also, this was a project started by McNamara, who was arguably the most hated Secretary of Defense in the country's history because of the war in Vietnam. So there was all this social unrest, all this, and under those circumstances, people were brought in who had been excluded, and there was a tremendous amount of bias, I would call it, about so-called low-aptitude people. And in Senate hearings, Senator Saltonstall referred to these as the low mental aptitude who are out there committing crimes, raping women, and so forth. And so it was a tremendous amount of hostility, both within the society at large and within the military in specific.
Yeah, I noted that you in the article you described, one person described them as McNamara's moron corps.
That's right. When I interviewed Mr. McNamara years after the project, he told me that. He said the people called it McNamara's moron corps. And so there was this whole pervasive kind of bias against the lower mental aptitude, and there was some considerable amount of racism involved because large percentages of the people scoring low on these paper and paper and pencil tests were African-American. So all these factors contributed. That is, the hate of the war in Vietnam. Remember the shootings on Ohio State University. Mm-hmm. And so all of that then led to very bad feelings about Project 100,000.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was asked then years later to analyze how those people had done, I looked at the official statistics and came to complete different conclusion from almost all of the oratory that had been going on and the rhetoric going on in which the Project 100,000 was declared a total failure and a disaster for the military. And so that's what I've written about now, again, bringing up to date newer research into the chapter in Scraping the Barrel. The actual performance of Project 100,000 people.
Yes.
I reached a completely different conclusion. And by the way, this hostility towards the project isn't just way in the past. In 2006, a New York Times article called "Don't Dumb Down the Army" called Project 100,000 the failed experiment of decades ago.
Well,
ancient history altogether here.
Oh, sure. Well, I could speak towards having the experience of graduate students who've written theses on Project 100,000 and coming across a largely negative, historical record of it, with very little positive to be said by it. But to be fair as well, it seems that many of the critiques that are leveled against the project seem to focus on the issue of racial insensitivity or upon its being used as a tool to facilitate, as Christian Appy describes in his book, Working Class War, the idea of, you know, the poor man fighting the rich man's war. Having, again, a class connotation to what Project 100,000 was.
That's right. After the project was over, years later, people writing about it would call it the failed experiment of years ago. And I looked at the data brand new back in 1987, mm-hmm. then again in the 90s, and then more recently when the New York Times article came out. And I realized that one of the problems was that there was this comparison of the Project 100,000 people with the non-Project 100,000 people, that is, those who were fully qualified. And I noted that's an interesting comparison, but it fails to answer the direct question, will we get any good service out of these people? And in doing that, I found that what happened was that, for instance, out of 100,000 people, 85,000 were successful. And yet the entire group was being called a failure.
When you describe success, what do you mean?
Beg your pardon?
When you say
I'm talking about that they completed basic military training, they completed job training, they completed their first term of service with honorable discharge and with ratings of good or satisfactory or above, all along that. And they had only about 3% had any disciplinary problems at all. Mm-hmm. In other words, 97,000 out of 100,000 didn't commit any of those horrible crimes that Senator Saltonstall was talking about. Didn't even have minor misdemeanor infractions. So this is what I said. When you look strictly at the 100,000 people themselves, how they performed, it's completely different than what was presented, because people were comparing them to the non-Project 100,000 people and would make claims like this. The Project 100,000 people had three times the disciplinary action. And that was true. But the non-Project 100,000 people had 1% infractions, and there were 3% for the Project 100,000. So that while that statement is literally true, it really does not give an accurate picture of the fact that 97 out of 100 of the Project 100,000 people had no problems at all.
Right, right. I mean, it falls within the margin of error of the sampling as well.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the whole argument is just totally fallacious in terms of representing how these people did in the military.
Why do you think there was such why do you think there remains such a desire to label this program as a failure?
You know, I think it's in part because a lot of people just who make these comments aren't really familiar as they should be with the data. They simply repeat what others have said. That's one thing I've noticed. And another thing is that they don't look at other activities of the military where they have used a lot of low-aptitude people. For instance, after Project 100,000, when the all-voluntary force started, by accident, the Department of Defense made mistakes in its norming of its aptitude test, and it brought in more people in the lower aptitude ranges by accident and without knowing they had them than they had done in all of Project 100,000. And during that time, there was zero arguments about low-aptitude people because they didn't know they had them. Hmm. In fact, I was working in West Germany at the time at headquarters USER in 1979, interviewing battalion commanders, and I was told repeated, these are the greatest people we've had. And I said, well, how about the new recruits? Because by then they had discovered that there had been this mistake. And they said, no, these are great. These are the greatest folks we ever had. So what I find here is this kind of, as I mentioned, a bias about people once they're categorized as being in the lower mental abilities. And a lot of that is there's a touch of racism because African-Americans were traditionally overrepresented in those levels. In fact, in one study that was done in a book called Marginal Man in the Military Service, they pointed out that during World War II, a lot of the people were being categorized as in the lower mental quality.
Right.
And they were having all sorts of complaints from commanders. And so personnel people simply cut in half the range that would be called lower mental ability. And they called them higher mental ability. After that, all complaints stopped.
Huh.
So there's real reason to believe that bias is involved here. Also, the idea that the military simply wants to be seen as something better than how it was seen in the Vietnam War era.
Right.
From the military side, they just don't want to have that negative perspective anymore. So I argued years ago when I was a member of the National Commission on Testing and Public Policy, I argued along with other members of the commission that we should regard these kind of standardized test scores with a great deal of skepticism, be very careful about how we are able to go around and classify people as not fit for something based upon a single test score or even a small battery of test scores. It excludes lots of people from opportunities that they could, in fact, be successful in. So I come out of that kind of a perspective after having studied all these years of work on low mental ability in the military, and I read a lot of the congressional testimony. I recall when this fighter named Cassius Clay was being considered for being military service and was rejected because of his low mental ability scores, and senators were just appalled that a man who could give poetry and bounce like a butterfly, that this man was being rejected from the Army because of low mental ability. This whole prevailing attitude that we have in this country and some other Western countries, I would say, about people, once we give them so-called IQ tests or we give them aptitude tests, and even when we give them tests like literacy tests, people who score low on these are frequently perceived to be totally incapable of learning and performing well in our modern society. And I think that's just a bad point of view for us if we're going to be trying to better the nation as a whole.
Well, let's call that then your historical assessment of Project 100,000 and its legacy for future generations and for those who read the article. As we close up our discussion of Scraping the Barrel, let's return to Sanders Marble for some closing thoughts. For all the benefits attending the use of substandard troops in wartime throughout all of our case studies, it clearly hasn't proven to be a perfect solution, has it?
No. And part of it is I think, the problem, if you label somebody substandard in peacetime, then you've given them it's like giving a dog a bad name. people had people, you know, military officers doubt this group and don't trust them, and often they are given less training or older equipment, and any problem that they give is blown or suffer is blown out of proportion. And it's some that's a problem. Oftentimes there are just the men are. It's a nice idea, but the men actually aren't up to it. You can look at the Bantam, the British experiment using two short men, undersized men in World War I. Some of them were robust miners. Some of them were just puny and couldn't hack it in trench warfare. So sometimes the idea is flawed. Sometimes execution is flawed. Sometimes the people that are rounded up, the Soviets in World War II rounded up political prisoners.
Right.
And they managed to make it work, at least to some degree. We know they did it, and they got some value out of it because they continued to do it. But at a level of compulsion that I think most countries would shy away from.
Yeah. You know, in your conclusion, you bring to bear a critical point that I think needs repeating, too. You know, as the United States and really other Western powers enter the information age, physical strength really is no longer a sole criterion for military service. You know, we look at intelligence, reflexes, intuition, even moral judgment, all becoming requisite factors for individuals who are entering the military, you know, who will be taking on evolving roles in the military. I'm thinking about, you know, piloting unmanned vehicles, for example, or cyber warfare or information warfare. That said, is it time, perhaps, for our military institutions to reassess what skills are most needed and revise the classification of fitness to incorporate these other, perhaps, ancillary factors?
Well, our timing on this interview is pretty impeccable.
Isn't it?
two days ago was the floating the balloon, and then yesterday Secretary of Defense Panetta announced that combat positions would be open to women. U.S. military. He doesn't have authority over everybody. Everybody's military, but at least in the U.S. I don't know. There is scope for classifying a wider range of jobs, I think, for people of inadequate physical capabilities.
Different capabilities.
Assessing what the specific physique and skills for various jobs are.
I mean, really, what do the skills require for piloting an unmanned vehicle? I mean,
playing a PlayStation 2 is probably skills you need. But as long as there's a need for people to carry heavy rucksacks and rifles and go up ridges and into villages and kick down doors, you can't. Warfare is not a push-button thing these days. More of it is push-button, but not all of it.
Not all of it yet. Still need for boots on the street.
Yeah, because if you just rely on remote targeting and such, you get into nasty ethical questions of assassinations and collateral damage, and the enemy will hide amongst civilian populations and such. We don't have an answer. I think this will continue to evolve. I think most of these historical cases where a group was substandard for race, those are, at least in the U.S. military, and most of the Western militaries, I think those are over. So this continued discussion on this topic will probably focus on gender and on non-Western militaries. But before we say that there is no real need for physical strength in the military or endurance and such, it's also worth looking at an evolving battlefield where, yes, many people are in rear areas, maybe even a continent away, flying a remotely piloted vehicle. But supply convoys are getting ambushed every day or every week. Mm-hmm. And instead of being able to say, oh, well, only the infantry and people in armor units are in combat and need to be strong or male, we're finding that everybody needs to have a level of physical ability and you know,
cognitive concentration too, yeah.
But also training in how to respond to an ambush. They mm-hmm. can't just be trained as truck drivers. They can't just be trained as military police or whatever, you know, signals personnel to operate, you know, the radios and
mm-hmm.
Computer networks. They have to be able to defend themselves and counterattack. They you know, obviously won't be equipped and trained the same way the infantry are, but too few people that are fully physically fit will raise problems.
And I think that's a good place to close our discussion of the book, you know, which makes, you know, it's a very timely volume and, again, very evocative essays. Sanders, got to ask you our last question. This, of course, was an edited volume, a different set of conditions and circumstances
sure.
for the Sander monograph. But do you have any ideas for a future monograph? What are your plans going forward for your next project?
I do have a monograph coming out shortly, which goes back to my earlier dissertation work on artillery on the Western Front, Western Front in World War I.
Mm-hmm.
So, but that's not what I'm working on now because that's finished essentially.
Right.
I'm just looking forward to massive royalties.
aren't we all?
Yeah. I'm not sure. I'm interested in a particular battle in World War I. It was a one-day affair where the Germans were actually. In the middle of March 1918, when the Germans are usually thought to be running rampant over the British and even the French,
mm-hmm.
When the French came up to help. But in this particular circumstance, the Germans were just stopped cold, took massive casualties, and by mid-afternoon, Ludendorff had decided that wasn't going to work, and he needed to shift elsewhere.
Hmm.
I am working with another a co-editor on another edited volume. That's a transnational history of artillery in World War I with different chapters on different countries.
Mm.
And again, I think the edited approach works for that because you do have different subject matter experts. I'm optimistic that will be a useful piece. I don't think it's going to sell a lot. But it will be in university bookshelves for people to benefit from.
And it'll probably open a lot of reading lists and a lot of dissertations, too, which is just as valuable as a lot of copies.
Yeah. Can educate the next generation of scholars, even if we're not reaching a wide audience. or maybe reaching them indirectly is the way to think about it. Because those folks write things and start teaching, then it will. This will, that kind of book will ripple more than it will sell a million copies like Stephen Ambrose.
Right. Well, let's not count on this. Let's not count on this one sending ripples out as well. Sanders Marble, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
And we'll also thank Tom Sticht for taking the time out of his schedule to speak with us. I enjoyed our talk, and looking forward to your next works. In the meantime, on behalf of New Books in Military History, take care. You've been listening to our interview with Sanders Marble and Tom Sticht about their recent essay collection, Scraping the Barrel, The Military Use of Substandard Manpower, 1860 to 1960.
On behalf of New Books in Military History, this is your host, Bob Wintermute, thanking you for listening.